Sherry Mitchell is a Penobscot from Maine, and she's a lawyer, has been involved in human rights work for a very long time, and she's a very inspiring teacher about change and social transformation. This is a prayer for healing and openness from her book, Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change. My fate is twined with the fate of destiny, held in perpetuity with all life, spiraling all the way back to the beginning of time. As I move towards my highest expression, the wisdom of ages is wrapped around me like a cloak. It moves with me, shifting to match my own unique rhythm, and then integrating that rhythm into the movement of creation. Let that cloak be a comfort to me in times of trial. Allow me to open myself to this wisdom and let it soften my defenses against it, knowing that any pain that I feel during this process is caused by denying the wise enticement of my own true heart. I seek to become a willing vessel and to open my heart completely to those whom fate has drawn to me. Allow me to see them not through the obscured vision of my own wounding or the defensive shelter created by theirs, but with the clarity of vision that can reveal their soul to me. Give me strength to remain seated in this pursuit beyond the levels of my own discomfort and fear, so that I may become the boundless being that you have created me to be, capable of embracing all life and capable of giving and receiving all the love that the divine spirit holds for me. My heart thanks you for all my relations. We've always been resilient. Since we evolved as a species on the earth, the same is true of all our relations, all other life forms, plants and animals, fish and birds, fungi and insect, and even worms. The capacity for resilience comes with the equipment of our bodies, from conception and maybe even before. It's passed on in our DNA with the dreams and lessons learned from our ancestors, formed from the history of being in relationship with a dynamic environment, with the elements, with our own species, and with others. And we barely understand a fraction of what this really means. We've come to learn that this capacity for resilience not only exists across diverse life forms, but also exists at all levels of life, from the intelligence of the cell membrane to the coordinated and collective resiliency of organ systems to the whole collaborative venture of our individual bodies, including the at least 11-foot electromagnetic field that comes from our heart.
It's just the P's. So try not to get the P's on the mic.
The P's? You mean this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The capacity for resiliency is also present in our relationships and our families, in our communities, and even in our organizations. It's also in our social identities of race and gender, sexual orientation and class, age and ability, culture, and so many other ways. Wherever there is a physical or psychological skin around an identity, there exists a living system with its own capacity for resiliency. The capacity to track information from the inside and from the environment and to respond in ways that are intended to help that identity survive and wherever possible to thrive. To participate in this amazing dynamic life on Earth and to pass on what we've learned to the living and unborn offspring of all species. How do we recognize resiliency? How do we decide when we've been resilient? Resilience has so many faces. One face is forward-looking. Here we create ways to be prepared for the predictable situations and also uncertain possibilities. We create tools to ready us for both real and imagined circumstances of adverse stress that might undermine our safety or our well-being. The water stored in our house for when the power goes out and the well won't work. The blanket and the flare in my car I hope to never use if there's an accident. The self-defense skills that I review in my mind when I'm walking in the dark on streets. A second phase of resiliency is for navigating through stress in present time. What skills we bring to paddle through the rapids of adversity, our favorite oars, our sense of balance, our fittest muscles. A third is the phase of rebound and recovery. When or if the rapids return to a state of relative stability or calm, here we may shake or we might cry and lick our paws. Here we tend to our wounds and take stock of the lessons that we've learned. And as quickly as possible, we typically try to resume life as it was before the rapids. A fourth phase of resiliency is that of transformation, the role of resiliency in adaptation and in change. This phase doesn't get acknowledged very much, but sometimes it's just not adequate or not appropriate to try to recreate the status quo. Sometimes life demands or calls us to reconsider where or who we were before. This kind of transformation resiliency tends to be harder for us. We tend to feel attached to the way things are and who we've been. We tend to rebuild on our fault lines and floodplains after earthquakes and storms level the landscapes. We are endowed with enormous creativity as humans as part of our resiliency, yet we're also vulnerable, as the saying goes, to doing the same things over and over in the hopes that there will be different results. All four of these phases of resiliency are essential to life. When teaching a course on stress at Ithaca College for a number of years, I had a chance to travel through the research on resiliency. It's become a topic of great interest in these days in academia and in mainstream culture, right along with mindfulness, which is very good news. The general trend in resiliency research was to look primarily at three types of situations where people survived and even thrived despite difficult circumstances. One was people who have lived through the horrors of the Holocaust or prison camps and other forms of violence and terrible abuse. The second was people who work in high-stress jobs. And the third was people, particularly children and young people, who were identified early on as high risk and predicted to not thrive based on the environments where they were growing up, typically associated with poverty. While there are important differences in these situations, there are three common themes and qualities that correlated with resiliency across those differences. The first is called locus of control, or a sense of agency. What does this mean? That people were able to find some amount of control, no matter how small, that let them prepare or steer through or rebound from adverse circumstances. This could be really as simple as learning something, learning a skill, something that makes them happy, learning to play an instrument or play a sport, to play music, to run, to dance, to read, making art, journaling, any number of things that are like that to build confidence. But it could even be holding a brief thought and repeating it as a mantra over and over again under horrible circumstances. One Holocaust survivor said that no matter what anyone did, no one could make him deny his understanding of what was happening and what was true. And this fact on its own was empowering for him as he lived through the nightmare of the camp. The second theme was optimism, and this means real optimism. Turns out that false optimism doesn't create resiliency, and because people know it isn't real. But optimism that's realistic was empowering and fosters resiliency. An example of pretend optimism would be automatically saying, oh, it's gonna be fine. No worries, it's gonna get better. Truer optimism might sound like, well, people often will drop everything to help each other in hard times. Or, we can work this out somehow. I do not know how, but I'm certain that we can work this out somehow. A third theme was connection. Connection includes connection with other humans, but it can also be connection to the entire natural world. How many people in here go to the trees or go to the ocean or the waters or outside somewhere when you're unhappy or overwhelmed or sad or needing some guidance? Even from the time we're little people, we know to do this. It's natural for us. This connection can also be to a higher power or one's higher self or your idea or notion, experience of God. One amazing fact about the power of connection is that some young people became resilient under tremendous hardship because someone sometime believed in them. And it didn't even have to be a long-term relationship. Some people reported that somewhere along the way, someone looked at them, contacted them, and knew they were worth something, and they never forgot that had a lifelong influence over them in their life. Now, it's important to take a moment here to clarify that lots of resilient people get sick and die economically poor and with hardship, don't thrive in other ways. In this society where we value pulling our bootstraps, as well as the myth of meritocracy, the notion that if you work hard, you will necessarily thrive, it's really important to be clear about this, that there is actually no direct correlation between working hard and thriving. This is tricky because we know that many of us who thrive also work very hard, don't we? And so it can be tempting to just think that sums up the whole story. But everywhere around this globe, we know the fact, the truth, that people wake up before dawn and work all day long into the night, and many, many of them live hardship their entire lives till they die. So it's important for us to not blame and not misattribute. That said, there is important information in these themes of agency and optimism and connection. We can integrate them as resources in our inner compass and help us. We can apply them to all four faces of resiliency to help us prepare for adversity, to paddle through it, to recover from it, and also to transform. This should be no surprise to you as a Unitarian Universalist community, because these themes are woven into the fabric of your principles. We first experiment with resiliency as very small children, often during times of feeling scared or feeling overwhelmed. Instinctively, in our little mammalian bones, we knew we needed to stay connected with the adults around us in order to survive. So belonging becomes very important to us, doing things to belong. We're not like the snakes who hatch and venture off with their own instruction booklets. Maybe as little people, we are entertaining and make people laugh. Maybe we smile, or maybe we hug people. Maybe we perform in ways that make people proud. Maybe we become helpers or peacemakers. Maybe we go inward and become very quiet. Maybe we cry or yell for others who don't know how. None of these things are bad things, hardly. These are all brilliant expressions of aliveness and resilience in children. The challenge is that as we age, these initial resilient responses can become outdated and rigid or unconscious. We may even identify or define ourselves by them and make them our favorite tool in our toolbox. You likely all know the phrase, if the only tool we had was a hammer. We tend to think that everything is a nail. This would work out fine if everything was a nail, but it's not. We may even forget that we have other choices about how to be in the world. Ricky Shervar Marcuse, one of my beloved teachers, said, all policies are the scar tissue of an unhealed wound. Rigid patterns of behavior are much like policies and serve the same functions. To avoid pain, we try to make reality predictable and as risk-free as possible. This also applies to families and groups and cultures and nations. Our resiliency strategies can be learned from earlier generations who passed on their templates for surviving and, in the best case scenario, for thriving. Some are learned from a painful event, a lost harvest, a job layoff, disease, or a fire. Others are learned from cumulative adversity, such as racism and sexism, classism, and other forms of systemic violence. When there is intergenerational exhaustion and despair, when a people aren't able to grieve the depth of our losses, this can be carried in our ways of responding and can affect the health of our resiliency patterns. What if the steady, resilient pulling of bootstraps that got people through the potato famine is not healthy as a lifestyle when we're not in crisis? What if constant bootstrapping keeps people from rest and repair or good judgment about managing ordinary stress? Or for a generation traumatized by violence, it might be initially resilient to not talk about that trauma. It's simply too overwhelming. But what if the silence carried over generations no longer serves a group's resiliency? What if the protected stories need to be told for a group to heal and transform? What if the child's resiliency response of making people laugh becomes a habit that keeps her from learning to take herself seriously when needed? What if the child's resiliency pattern of being quiet is harnessing the very voice that the world is waiting for? While we long for aliveness and possibility, the pull to stay the same and repeat the old formulas is so common and so compelling. I sometimes try to imagine how it was to believe that the earth was flat. Can you imagine this? Just even now, taking a moment to imagine the earth is flat. All the ways you and your world would be shaped by this. Imagine what you'd feel when you walked towards the horizon. And now imagine if you were there the day that the word went out and it was announced that the earth was round. And what you would feel when you got that information. How that would feel inside, how that would affect you. Can you imagine this? And now just add to that learning that not only is the earth round, but it's actually been round the entire time. Triple wow. We've all had key moments in our lives when something we learned transformed us. Some were lessons that were hard to lean into because they challenged our understandings about reality and about ourselves. For example, when I realized that the negative limiting beliefs I held about myself were almost entirely based on a child's innocent misunderstanding, much like misunderstanding that the earth is flat. And when it became clear that it has always been true that I and all of us are worthy and lovable and belong and have rights and deserve to exist and to thrive, as true as the earth is round and always has been, how would we change if we really understood this about ourselves? If we let our resilience update our understanding of who we truly are? Sometimes we learn information that confuses us and troubles us and requires some serious paddling through internal rapids. Then, without quite understanding what happened, our lens has shifted and we've transformed. For me, when I learned that good white people participate in racism without even trying or without even intending to, and good men in sexism, and so on. When I learned that there wasn't scarcity on the earth, but that there's a distribution problem. When I learned that God might be a verb. When I learned that the golden rule missed the boat and that we should do unto others the way they actually want us to do unto them. When I learned that there is no such thing as inaction. When I learned that the one thing that is always true is that many things are true at once. When I learned that good intentions don't always create good impact and don't make a hurtful impact go away. Some recent ones I'm working on being changed by. Gender isn't binary, it's fluid. White people need to lead more by following people of color and being available as a resource, even if we're experienced and smart and old. Living the gender traditionally conforming to my biology privileges me over transgender people. Many working class Republicans believe that Donald Trump is making the world better. You have your own list. How is it going, learning, and changing? Thomas Satz, a psychiatrist, once said, "Every act of conscious learning requires a willingness to suffer some injury to one's self-esteem." This is why young people, before they become aware of their own self-importance, learn so quickly, and why pride and vanity are often greater obstacles to learning than stupidity. This doesn't mean we have to have our self-esteem injured, but we need to have a certain kind of openness. What can help us tolerate the discomfort of learning and change? After the rapids, it requires different resiliency muscles to change than to return to the status quo. And I am quite certain that we can't all be, we're meant to be, without trying to do this. These are such challenging times, times of conflict and stress where the powers that be are very invested in trying to divide us and to instill fear in us. We have big paths ahead and they require all the faces of our resiliency. If we consider these three resiliency themes of control, optimism, and connection, what might we apply to the vulnerable edges of transformation? In Rising Strong, Brené Brown talks about the stages of transformation and offers the first two on this list. One, we can decide to stay the course. Paraphrased here, experience doesn't create even a single speck of light in the darkness of confusion and vulnerability. It only instills in you a little bit of faith in your ability to navigate in the dark. This phase is messy, but it's also where the magic happens. And how can we truly learn to trust each other if we aren't willing to stay the course? Two, we can choose to be curious. Again, in Brené's words, curiosity is an act of vulnerability and courage. We can decide to be brave enough to want to know more. When we do, curiosity can outweigh discomfort, even when we're scared. How do we come to those aha moments if we're not willing to explore? New information won't transform our thinking, much less our lives, if it simply lands at our feet or gets pushed away in judgment. To be integrated into our lives as true awareness and change, we have to be received with an open hand, with inquisitive minds, and with wondering hearts. Einstein says, "The important thing is to not stop questioning." Curiosity, he says, has its own reason for existence. It exists not simply as a tool to be used in acquiring knowledge. It reminds us that we're alive. 3, lean into the edges and make friends with confusion. Confusion is a terribly undervalued emotion. Have you ever learned anything without at least a bit of confusion? It signals that something is moving, the plates are shifting, and more will be revealed. 4, choose compassion and love for ourselves, for others, and for the world. In an interview, the Dalai Lama once said, "I don't know why people are always describing me as compassionate. I'm not very compassionate." And then he was quiet for a moment. And he said, "Maybe it's because I care about compassion." We might not be able to tell how things will turn out, but we can control whether we care about bringing love to the table. We won't be able to be loving all the time, but we can care about bringing love to the table. The HeartMind researchers show that the brain alone can only make decisions based in the past. But the heart actually releases hormones that can shift the state of our nervous system, allowing us to think to include new and uncharted possibilities in our thinking. One way I practice this heart access skill is at the gym, a favorite predictable place to spend time with my judgmental side. I'll just ride the bike and watch my judgmental thoughts have a field day. Why does that person need all those muscles? What's up with that outfit for working out? What's that person trying to prove anyway? Then I switch my awareness and imagine that each person is my son or daughter and watch what happens. Oh, it's so good that he's spending time in his body. What discipline it must have taken to get so strong. Oh, good for her for pulling out such bright, affirming colors. We can choose to shift our state of consciousness in ways that make us more open and compassionate, and from here become more resilient in our relationships. 5, breathe. It's on every list. We can use our breath to bring us home, to settle us, to come up on shore, where we can think more clearly. 6, cultivate mindfulness, alone and with others. We can choose this. We can practice noticing and learning what we do and who we are. As we do, we can discern which patterns of response add to our resiliency and which no longer serve our path. 7, slow down, allow for the mystery, and listen. I love this one. As we explore problems and issues together, we can and need to bring all of our best thinking forward to help. But what if there's another resource available only for the tapping? What if life itself wants to weigh in? What if there's something outside the box, outside of our awareness, that will percolate up into consciousness if we just allow life itself, the mystery, to speak to us? What if we take our time to hear this? Sherry Mitchell, again in her book, Sacred Instructions, tells of the Wabanaki clan mothers who carried problems into the lodge where they prayed and deliberated, sitting with the problem until a solution became clear. She said they never hurried in their decision making. They took the time needed to seek a spirit-based solution that balanced the need for action with the sacredness of life. They took the time needed to seek a spirit-based solution that balanced the need for action with the sacredness of life. 7, finally, letting ourselves remember what's deep in our bones. Again, Sherry Mitchell from Sacred Instructions. Our ancestors knew how to live within the realm of active creation and how to speak life into being. They understood the language of the land and the waters. They spoke to the plants and the animals. They heard the subtle voice of creation and they saw the interconnectedness among all living things. As a result, they worked in concert with the natural rhythms that surround them, knowing that their lives were tied inextricably to all living beings and to the living earth as well. This remembering is our birthright and sings forth the resiliency of all life for looking forward, for paddling through, for restoring, and for transformation. Dear Spirit, guide us each and every one when and how to bend, and when and how to be firm. We offer our songs, our fierce cries, and our soft bellies in gratitude for our lives. Amen. Blessed be.